Okay. So, for that, a bit of background. Does this work? It's not. So, currently, our best description of space-time is provided by general relativity, which says that space-time, gravity is the curvature of space-time around massive bodies. So, general relativity, it's a really good theory. It's made a number of predictions that have been confirmed, and it's been tested extremely accurately. And yet, physicists don't believe that it's the final word. In particular, they expect that it's going to be an incorrect description of the universe at extremely short length scales and extremely short time scales. Here, it's supposed to be replaced by a theory of quantum gravity, because in this regime, quantum effects are going to become important that aren't taken into account by general relativity. And quantum gravity is supposed to not actually describe space-time, but whatever this underlying unknown quantum physics is that's somehow responsible for the appearance of space-time and gravitational phenomena in the regimes where we do use general relativity and where it has been really well tested. So this physics is supposed to be non-spatiotemporal to some extent, and yet GR, with its conception of space-time, should be recoverable from quantum gravity in the domains where we know it works. Okay, a bit of a disclaimer. Currently, there is no theory of quantum gravity, so it's all pretty speculative. Instead, though, we do have a number of incomplete approaches, so different research programs, different states of development, and doing different things. Okay, so there's actually another domain where general relativity is expected to be incorrect, and that's the Big Bang singularity. So basically, based on current observations of the large-scale structure of the universe, put this into the laws of GR and run them backwards in time, what we see is the universe contracting to a maximally hot, dense state. But at some point, actually, our equations stop giving sensible solutions. They just break down. And one interpretation of this is that here again, there's some sort of unknown quantum effects that need to be taken into account, and so we'll need a theory of quantum gravity to explain what happens at the Big Bang. So we have two different places that quantum gravity is supposed to describe. Firstly, it's supposed to give us the physics that's underlying our description of space-time. And moving from this more fundamental non-spatiotemporal description to general relativity may be an example of synchronic emergence, so holding between different levels of description. As Sebastian just talked about, the synchronic emergence, the micro and the macro. But also, there's this other conception where the physics, we go from a universe with some non-spatiotemporal state into a state where we do have space-time. And this may be an example of diachronic emergence. So, relating two different states at the same level, as you were, but at different times. So, we get a bit stuck here because, yeah, the idea of diachronic emergence and synchronic emergence are framed in terms of time, and yet we may be talking about a state without time to a state with time, rather than a process in time. So it's a bit tricky to try and use these terms, but I'm still going to use them because this is what we use, you know, quite standardly in emergence literature. And I think there's some non-spatiotemporal analogues of these two notions that can carry over to these examples. Okay, so today I'm going to explore these two potential examples of space-time emergence and see if they can be understood according to existing accounts of emergence, and conversely, what challenges they might pose for existing accounts of emergence. So I'll start by first explaining what emergence is. I won't spend too long on that. Sebastian's done a really good job. I'll then look at synchronic accounts of emergence. before applying them to this example of space-time, then turning to diachronic accounts and seeing how they apply in the example of space-time, and conclusions. So what do I mean by emergence? The general schema, it's an asymmetric relationship between two relata of the same nature, let's say an emergent E, which emerges from some basis B. And we've got this general schema of dependence, where E is somehow dependent on, perhaps determined by, constituted by, etc., B. But it's also novel to some extent, exhibits striking features not possessed by B. Also take autonomy as a separate third condition. The idea is that E is somehow unpredictable or irreducible or unexplained, or the positive account is that it's robust against changes in its basis. So this is a general schema which gets filled in by different accounts of emergence. For me, like Sebastian, I'm going to take emergence as a relation between parts of physical theories. So E and B are theories or theory parts. But again, like Sebastian, you can also interpret this as holding between the ontologies of the two theories. So the two different varieties of emergence that we're interested in, firstly, synchronic emergence. Here, E and B represent different levels of description. So theories that apply, for instance, at different length scales. And these theories are supposed to apply to the same system at the same time, or otherwise under the same conditions. So there's no change except in the level at which you're viewing the system. And typically in physics, it might be the energy scale at which you probe the system. So B might describe higher energy, you know, shorter length scale theory, and E the lower energy, and a large scale macro theory. Conversely, in diachronic emergence, E and B are at the same level of description. So for instance, the same energy or length scale. Again, they're supposed to apply to the same system, but it's at different times or otherwise under different conditions. The idea is that the system's undergone some sort of change. Typically, B will describe it before and E will describe it after. So it's a diagram here. So this is your system at T1, viewed at level N1, so the micro level. And then at T2, it looks like this, something's happened. And then there's two ways of viewing it. If you're interested in diachronic emergence, you just stick to that one level and you look at it at two different times and see the relationship between these two different states. Or if you're interested in synchronic emergence, you can just work at one time, so here it's T2, but view it at a higher level and explore the relationship between the description at the higher level and at the lower level. Okay. So turning now to the synchronic accounts of emergence, in particular my own account, which is inspired by the framework of effective field theory, but I'm not going to explain what effective field theory is. Basically, it's a method or a toolbox for constructing effective field theories. And an effective field theory is a theory that's valid only at a given level. So for instance, at low energy scales compared to some heavy mass lambda. And as you increase your energy approaching this heavy mass, the theory will break down. Nevertheless, if you're only interested in low energies, the theory will be very accurate and very useful, so long as you're just interested in low energies compared to that heavy mass. And the reason for this is that it's framed in terms of the appropriate degrees of freedom for its level, and it's also effectively independent of the physics at the higher energy scales. So you can use your effective theory without needing to know what's going on at the higher energy scales. And the reason for this was explained by this mathematical apparatus of the renormalization group, which shows that actually most of the high energy interactions are actually irrelevant at lower energies. And the ones that do filter down can be absorbed into your parameters that you're working with in your theory. So there's a heuristic example of this. Maybe it's a bit light, but these analog models of space-time in fluids. So basically, you have a fluid, it's composed of some particles or molecules, and if you hit it with a small amount of energy, these particles are going to vibrate, you're going to get sound waves. If you quantize the sound waves, you end up with phonons, which are sound particles. So they're actually nothing over and above these collective excitations of whatever your underlying particles or molecules are. So what's remarkable is that these phonons behave as though they're in a curved space-time, like oblivious to what's going on at the micro level, which may be, you know, flat space-time. but as we increase the energy, your phonons will have shorter wavelength, and eventually it will be of the same order as this lattice spacing between your particles, and they'll detect the underlying fluid and your theory will break down. Okay, so this effective Lagrangian that describes your phonons, it's effectively formally identical to that of a massless scalar field in curved space-time. And actually how you get this, it's just a generic feature of the linearization process that you use in constructing the models. So it depends on actually very little of the details of your system. You can do this in many different types of fluids, for instance. So back to emergence, my account, starting with the idea of dependence, we can say that the effective low energy theory, the emergent theory, is constructed or derived from its higher energy basis theory. And also the physics described by your emergent theory can be said to supervene on those of your basis theory. So this means that any change in the laws at the E level will reflect some change in the laws at the B level. So if our large scale laws were different, it would mean that our more fundamental physics is different. But a change in the laws at the B level may not reflect necessarily a change in the laws at the emergent level. We have novelty, so the physics described by the lower energy macro theory is very different from that of the higher energy micro theory. And we have autonomy, the physics described by E is robust against changes in the microphysics, and actually B, basis theory, is actually underdetermined. If you only have your emergent theory, your more basic one, you're not going to be able to tell what it is. And there's two senses of this due to universality or multiple realizability of your emergent theory. So firstly, you can have different microstates or different models described by B, which correspond to a single macro state in your emergent theory. So for instance, in statistical mechanics, you can have different microstates corresponding to the same macro state in thermodynamics. But also you can have different micro theories that give you the same macro theory. So for instance, thinking about your fluids in the analog space-time, if your fluid is water, it's going to be described by theories of chemistry. If your fluid is something exotic like a Bose-Einstein condensate, it's going to be described by quantum mechanics. And yet these can both give rise to the same hydrodynamics at larger scales. So in the example here, we have dependence because the effective theory describing your phonons is constructed from your higher energy theory. And as we've seen, the phonons are collective phenomena the low energy excitations of these underlying particle molecules. So we have dependence. We have novelty. The theories are characterized by different degrees of freedom and different symmetries. So your effective theory with the phonons, it's Lorentz invariant, it's curved space-time, while that of the ground state of the fluid is Galilean variant. And Jonathan Bain has emphasized this a lot in his work on emergence. Also, we have a sense of autonomy because this effective metric is incredibly easy to obtain from a variety of different systems, as I've said, of different microconstitutions. So the actual high energy theory is underdetermined. So that was one example of emergent space-time, synchronic emergence. We'll now look at how it applies in the case of quantum gravity. So in quantum gravity, generally, the reduction of general relativity to quantum gravity is a criterion of theory acceptance. So in order for a theory of quantum gravity to be accepted as a theory of quantum gravity, it has to be able to, we have to think that it's able to reproduce all the successful results of GR. And this means establishing various formal correspondences between the two theories such that we believe that GR is deducible in principle from quantum gravity. So these relations are supposed to establish that GR, with its conception of space-time, depends on quantum gravity. So necessarily, the dependence condition of emergence must be satisfied in quantum gravity. However, I've argued that there's no guarantee that the other two conditions for emergence must be satisfied. So general relativity is not guaranteed to emerge from quantum gravity. In fact, there are many approaches to quantum gravity that just don't seem to have space-time being so novel and autonomous from them at all. Nevertheless, there's many other examples where they could plausibly be emergent. And today I'm just going to look at one, loop quantum gravity. So I'm going to go over this really quickly because it's not important at all for what I'm about to say. But loop quantum gravity, it's canonical quantization. So you cast GR into Hamiltonian form and then quantize it. So this involves setting up and solving the theory in terms of constraint equations, which are formulated in terms of loop variables. And the Hamiltonian constraint equation, which is supposed to describe the dynamics of the theory, is quite difficult to solve. This is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So at the moment, it's really only the kinematics of the theory that's known. I'm going to just be working at this level. However, there are different approaches towards understanding the dynamics of the theory. So loop quantum gravity, it describes blobs of space-time. So this is supposed to be like blobs of space-time. In the theory, these get represented by abstract graphs known as spin networks. So this is a spin network. So the nodes of your spin network represent quanta of volume. So that's your blob. And they're adjacent if there's a link between them, and the links represent the quantized area of the surface bounding volumes. So the surface area of your blob. So, can we say that space-time emerges from these blobs? Well, the dependence aspect, without having the full dynamics of the theory, it's quite difficult to tell how we will be able to get space-time out of loop quantum gravity. But on the other hand, we've seen the spin networks are the result of quantizing space-time, and space is supposed to correspond to quantum superposition of spin networks. So for the sake of this talk, we're just going to suppose that we do have dependence and that GR reduces to loop quantum gravity in the requisite way. What about novelty and autonomy? So Huggett and Vitruk have done a lot in explaining this idea of novelty. So there are many different states or aspects that they discuss, emphasizing how different these spin networks are from space. Firstly, there's some peculiar form of non-locality where, so spin networks that are close to each other in the fundamental structure, in the emergent space-time, or space, they're not actually next to each other as they are down here. Also, there's, so that's one sense in which these two structures are very different. Also, the generic states in loop quantum gravity are supposed to be superpositions, so there's no clear notion of geometry. Also, oh yeah.
What is spinning?
Spinning?
What, you say these are spin networks. Is it like an Ising model?
No, nothing like that. The name, it's from the way, actually Penrose came up with this idea of spin networks independently, and the way you label them is in terms of half-integer spins, I think. So it's just, it's a bit unrelated. It's nothing actually spinning. So yeah, there's also this problem of time where we can't solve the dynamics. So that's a sense in which it's different. Okay, so also we have a sense of autonomy. So many different spin network states can correspond to the same semi-classical geometry. And also there's models of loop quantum gravity that don't correspond to space-time. So I think, yes, we plausibly have novelty and autonomy that could give us a potential example of space-time emergence in loop quantum gravity. Okay, so next up we'll look at the diachronic accounts of emergence. Our first candidate is by Kay and Sardinaire. They call it transformational emergence. So here, E and B are different states of the same system, interpreted at the same level, but different times. E and B are supposed to be different models of the same theory. And the dependence condition on their account says that E is the product of a spatiotemporary continuous process going from B. There's novelty because E exhibits new entities, properties, or powers that don't exist in B, and the autonomy is that these new properties or powers are forbidden to exist in B. So this isn't really going to work. I think we need something more general. So my more general proposal, again, you know, we keep E and B as being different states of the same system, but we get rid of this reference to time. The dependence, so it can't be a spatiotemporally continuous process going from B to E. But also, even if we have some sort of dynamics in terms of some continuously varying parameter from B to E, we just have like an ordering so between the states. And whether you want to say that one depends on the other is conventional. Which one's earlier, which one's later is just convention. So I don't see how we can call this dependence. Another option is to say that E is caused by B, but then I don't really understand what it means to say that one state of a system is caused by another state of the system. So I think we need some sort of non-temporal notion that will give us basis for a claim of priority. So I'm going to say something like flat supervenience, where again, a change in E would necessarily reflect a change in B. But if you change B, you're not necessarily going to get a change in E. And one potential candidate for this relation is that of counterfactual causation put forward by Baron Miller and Cohen. I haven't yet looked into this, but I will. So next up, we have novelty. So E again describes new entities, properties, or powers that don't exist in B. But novelty is always just relative and symmetric. It just captures the ways in which E and B differ from one another. So without having this asymmetry in the dependence or in the novelty, I think we need, we can get it, but through this notion of autonomy, something that will give us a notion of priority and capture this asymmetry that we need for a claim of emergence. And I think we can do this by using a notion that's analogous to my synchronic sense of autonomy, which was based in underdetermination due to universality or multiple realizability. I think the corresponding diachronic notion is a sort of backward indeterminism, where if you've just got your E state, you don't know what the B state was because it could have been any number of things. Okay. So an example of this is ferromagnetism. I didn't know Sebastian was going to be talking about it, so it's pretty good I don't have to explain it. But just as a refresher, at your macro scale, you've got a material that's got, it's not magnetized. And that's because at the micro scale, well, it corresponds to a collection of spins, which are all randomly aligned. But decrease the temperature, and these spins will spontaneously align and give rise to a macro state where you do have a net magnetization. So looking just at the micro state, because recall in dichronic emergence, you have to look at the same level. B is the state where they're all random, and E is the state where they're all aligned. So I think we have dependence, but it's going to come out of the autonomy. So the autonomy is that your emergent state can arise from many different B states, and that B is underdetermined given E. So basically, there's many different ways in which these could be randomly pointed, but no matter how they're randomly pointed, you decrease the temperature, you're still going to get E. So I think this provides us the claim of flat supervenience or some sort of counterfactual causation. And also, clearly, we have novelty, because B is the state where we've got no preferred direction, and E is the state where we do. It's a broken symmetry. Okay. So let's see how this could potentially apply in the case of quantum gravity. Going back to, loop quantum cosmology, if you'll recall, I said the dynamics of loop quantum gravity is not well understood. And so loop quantum cosmology attempts to get around this by first simplifying the system by assuming that space is isotropic and homogeneous. You get the idea. The effect is that basically we can describe space-time with just one degree of freedom, which is a scale factor corresponding to quantum operator P. So the resulting simplified dynamical equation can be interpreted as an evolution equation, treating this scale factor as a time variable. And I'm taking this from Huggins Vitrick. All the next following slides are just from them. So once we have this simplified dynamic equation, we can run it backwards using the scale factor. And actually, it turns out that it doesn't go singular. What would be the Big Bang is just, it's no longer a singularity. It's well-defined. You can just go straight through the Big Bang. So we can run P backwards through the Big Bang and find out what loop quantum cosmology tells us about the universe before the Big Bang. So what we find is actually a mirror world. If this is the what would be the singularity, this is our universe expanding. And on the other side of the Big Bang, you actually have a universe that's contracting. So it's standardly interpreted as the universe undergoing a big crunch, collapsing to this maximally hot dense state and then re-expanding. And here are the corresponding spin networks of loop quantum cosmology. So it's your micro model and this is your macro theory. But Hugger and Vutrich argue that this picture isn't actually supported by loop quantum cosmology, because in this area there's actually no continuous notion of time that's connecting the pre-universe and the post-universe. This just doesn't have time. It's purely spatial. So Hugger and Vutrich argue that it's more natural to interpret time here as directed away from the Big Bang. So instead of being a universe contracting and then expanding, they say we've just got this timeless state, and then we have two universes expanding out. So they call it this twin birth, and they label this as the temporal emergence of space-time. Okay. So I want to ask, how can we understand this as emergence? And it seems like we have a few different options. The first option would be to think of the emergence of the atemporal state from this collapsing universe, say. Or you can have the standard interpretation of the emerging, expanding universe coming out of the atemporal state. Or you can take the Hugger and Vutrich interpretation, where we have B as this timeless state before the Big Bang, and then two universes being the emergent. So these are all supported by the same physics, whether you want to take this scenario or this scenario. So we're working just at the macro level. We'll suppose that E is the expanding spatiotemporal universe after the Big Bang, and B is the state of the universe before the Big Bang with no time. We ask, where's the dependence here? Which state depends on which? Does E depend on B, or does B depend on E? And given that you can take either way, I don't think we've got a clear notion of dependence here. What about novelty? Well, I think we definitely have novelty. We've gone from a state with no time to a state with time, different symmetries. But the autonomy, yeah, again, I think we just can't answer until we understand which state depends on which. So we actually might need to have some sense of autonomy in order to define the dependence condition. So I think no dependence, yes, novelty, and unknown to autonomy. But we can move to the micro level, because again, working diachronic emergence, you just stick to the same level. Here we take E as the micro state of the universe after the Big Bang, so it would correspond to a macro state with time, and B is the micro state of the universe before, so that's the one with no time. Here, again, E and B, they're just different states. They've got some relation in terms of something we're calling a time parameter. So they change with respect to one another, but without some sort of asymmetry which tells us which one is the prior one, I think any notion of dependence or directedness seems quite conventional. Also, when we're just working at this micro level, I think there's no obvious sense of autonomy. You can't see which one has time and which one doesn't have time until you move up to the macro scale. And also, the autonomy, again, we just don't know until we understand what's connecting these two states. So I think we don't really have a good candidate for emergence here. Okay. So that's it. In summary, I've presented emergence as dependence plus novelty and autonomy. I've argued that the key to synchronic emergence, what's important to characterize it, is this notion of autonomy, which is based in an underdetermination of B due to the multiple realizability of E. Presented some examples of synchronic emergence. We saw more from Sebastian. So the analog models of space-time, and potentially space-time from loop quantum gravity. I've also presented some criticism of diachronic emergence, being that I can't understand this idea of dependence. But my attempt to rectify this is to appeal to an asymmetric notion of autonomy. And I've presented a new account of diachronic emergence where dependence comes as sort of flat supervenience and autonomy as some sort of backward indeterminism, and the example being ferromagnetism. Finally, I've argued against Huggett and Vutrich, saying that we can't really understand these models of loop quantum cosmology as being temporal emergence of space-time. So, thank you.
Time for a couple of questions. Yes.
Thank you. I thought this